Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Let's pick up with this recent interview of myself, Radio EcoShock host Alex Smith, by Janiyah Donaldson, host of Peak Moment TV.
Actually, I just came across a map showing scientists who were doing forecasts on when we would see sea level, certain seacoast cities all over the world, what year they would be, you know, the water would be at their level. This is, of course, forecast. In a business as usual scenario and in a reduced emission scenario. And the earliest was in the 2020s. Well, sea level rise.
I'll tell you a surprising thing. The sea is not level. We base all our maps and everything. We say, oh, this is so many feet above sea level. The sea isn't level. There's as much as 100 feet difference in different parts of the world. Yes. Because the oceans are attracted to the mass that's on the bed of the sea.
Oh, sure.
Just as the moon changes the ocean, so does the different mass of the Earth.
Thank you for that. I always wondered why you'd have to have the Panama Canal with the Pacific and the Atlantic at two different heights. It's like, thank you. So, Alex, what you're saying is what we should, that's the thing that your latest guest saying, worry most about the sea level rise. We have so many major ports, seacoast cities. What are they going to do? Or what could they do?
Well, they'll start off by doing what New Jersey is doing, which is rebuilding what they had before. A giant mistake. Nature has already told you what is going to happen. You can put up sand berms, but only so high, and eventually those flood over. Some of the cities will do as London is doing and as Rotterdam has done. They'll put up sea gates to try and hold back the tides and the surges, and that could work. Possibly as long as 2050. After that, most of the scientists say it's just not going to work. You're going to have to build your ports higher, move some cities back further inland. Some ports, like the city of Alexandria, where the temples are already underwater, that will be what you will find in 2100, 2050 for some American and world ports.
One of my questions has to do with the interaction of positive feedback loops. That is, my understanding was that the IPCC reports didn't attempt to fit in how, say, melting polar caps, polar ice, bring more dark land into view, which means things are going to warm even more quickly. They didn't attempt to do that kind of multiplication effect, I guess is maybe what I should say. Have any of your guests talked about that?
Absolutely. That's one of the prime concerns of almost all of my guests, is how those things will interact, the feedback loops. And we just don't know. And scientists have found about 27 of them. There are all kinds of ways that these things interact. The world is a very complex system. It's a geochemical, physical, natural. Life changes. You know, if the plankton in the sea changes, a lot of things change. So we don't know. As I said, it's just one big experiment, and we're doing a kind of brinksmanship, especially our leadership, who have the reports available to them and don't call on the right experts to listen to and don't take the leadership role to make the changes in society that we all need. We have to elect the right people, but even when they're elected, they have to do the right things. I hope President Obama's listening when we talk about the Keystone XL pipeline.
Boy.
That's the wrong thing.
Absolutely.
To allow that to happen.
Yeah, that's James Hansen, one of your guests, has said that game over, that the Keystone Pipeline, that tar sands oil comes on down through the U.S. and gets refined and sent out and burnt in the air.
Well, one of the things that haunts James Hansen was that he began his career at NASA studying Venus. Venus is very hot. It has an atmosphere that's almost entirely carbon dioxide. And so it has a giant greenhouse world is what it is. There is some evidence that on either Venus or on Mars, there may have been conditions closer to what we find on Earth. There may even have been water on Mars. There's some indication that. Why did their atmosphere burn off? Is it possible, is it even in some science fiction world possible, that the atmosphere of Earth could go out of control? Most scientists believe it won't, because we have had warming incidents in the past, and it didn't. But none of them have happened so fast as we're making it happen now. So we don't really know. And I think that's what Hansen's worried about, is we could set things in effect that would change the world so dramatically that there will be no future human life. And I've spoke also to oceanographers and paleoclimatologists who have said that there is a type of microbe in the ocean that puts out hydrogen sulfide. And instead of oxygen, they put out hydrogen sulfide, which is a toxic gas to all of us mammals. They believe that is the cause of four previous mass extinctions on planet Earth. The oceans warm to a point where this type of microbe or plankton starts into effect. And that's why the dinosaurs survived and we did not. Their lung system was different. They could tolerate a certain amount of hydrogen sulfide. Mammals could not. There were a couple of little burrowing mouse-like pre-mammals that did survive. That's the only reason you and I are here. But that the reptiles could survive with this type of change in the ocean. So we don't want to see that happen. And it happens when oxygen goes down in the ocean. And that's what's happening right now. It's happening in the North Pacific. There are dead zones forming off the coast of Oregon. There are dead zones off the coast of Florida. And when we say dead zone, there's just no oxygen for life to live.
Wow. Yes. Right.
Yeah.
So that could tip into that kind of situation.
Another gigantic tipping point. If it happened, we hope it would take 100 or 200 years. But if it happens, we would become extinct. It's a real possibility. And people are just playing with this. It's amazing. I mean, I love my kids. I love my grandkids. I don't want them to have to suffer for the idea of us driving to the corner grocery store for a bottle of pop when we could have walked and it would have been better for our health anyway. So we can get into the solutions there. They're easy enough. They're right there. We can do it. We can do it with solar. We can do it with wind. We can do it with geothermal energy. We don't have to run ourselves off this planet.
I like that pitch. And the good news with, you know, the folks that we're meeting through Peak Moment TV are doing those kinds of changes. Whether or not they're doing it because of climate change, probably not, or even peak oil. Some of them are aware of those things, of course. But people that are wanting to relocalize, make more local their economy, their gardens, you know, building materials that come from their region. I certainly see that pulse happening.
All of those solutions help the climate tremendously. There's no question about it. If you're growing your own beans and canning them from the backyard instead of flying them in from Chile, you are helping out. So we talked about the bit of good news that the United States, for example, has reduced its emissions. Mm. Well, the other side of that good news is that millions of people are taking an interest in where their food comes from and getting good, healthy food locally. And millions of people are interested in building public transit. As soon as you build a public transit line, it's full.
Yes.
You know?
That's
so people are ready to go with this. We just need the leadership and we need the fossil fuel industries to back off their campaigns of denying climate change and pushing more and more development. They have to realize that they are a sunset industry.
Yes.
And go ahead and plan that way. We need our pension funds to realize that investing in fossil fuels is disinvesting in our human future. And stop doing that. So there are a lot of positive things that is happening, and it could happen a lot more.
Yes, for sure. I'm thinking about the students who've done campus campaigns to get their campus divested from the oil, the fossil fuel industries. I mean, they're the ones that whose future is being forfeited or severely contracted. I'm really glad to see young people making noise about it, being do action.
Right. Well, are we ready to switch up to the other big topic that's kind of threatening us all?
Yes. Talk to us about radioactivity in the broadest sense.
Yes. The Earth has a lot of radioactivity in it, but we evolved to that level so that we can handle the radioactivity that's there naturally. I mean, that just makes sense.
Sure.
But humans have gone underground and grabbed a lot more and concentrated it in the most amazing ways. We make a special type of uranium for atomic power plants, and then we make plutonium and uranium for nuclear weapons. We blew off a lot of it in the 1950s and 60s in gigantic bombs, and all of that is still in our bones and may be one of the prime causes of the cancers that are now sweeping a generation. Now, what happened at Fukushima, Japan? They had four old reactors that were American designed by General Electric. And they had the tsunami, which washed over them, took out their source of external power. Now, it's amazing to me. Here is a plant that will go ahead and produce all kinds of power, all kinds of electricity. But if it doesn't have electricity coming from the outside, it breaks down. And that's what happened at Fukushima.
Okay.
They can run for a few hours on batteries, but even the battery system and their backup diesel generators were washed over by the sea and wiped out. So after a few hours, their reactors began to heat up, and then they melted down, a classic meltdown system in three reactors, which has never been seen before on planet Earth. They went right down through the bottom of the containment system, went down into the bottom of the reactor building, which was by then flooded. And now the Japanese authorities will tell you they don't know where these nuclear fuels are. There's plutonium in there. There's all kinds of wild and weird radioactive materials in there. They don't know where they are. They're down there under the ground there somewhere. Who knows? So what they're doing is they're pumping millions of gallons of water in and out, trying to collect the radioactivity before it hits the Pacific Ocean.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Where's that water? I mean, that's contaminated water. That's radioactive
Highly
water.
Contaminated.
Where's that water going?
Well, they collect most of it. And most of it is going into storage tanks. They've got, I believe, up to about 1,000 storage tanks on the site now. They're building them all the time. It's like a new industry in Japan, just building storage tanks for the Fukushima system.
Wow.
Unfortunately, the storage tanks are just kind of bolted together, and they've got all kinds of mishmash of pipes leading to them, and they've leaked. There was a big leak in August, another one in October, and when they leak, they just flow over these tiny little containment areas and down into the Pacific Ocean. So we've had tons and tons of radioactive, highly radioactive water go into the Pacific Ocean just in the last 3 months, not to speak of all the stuff that went in there when they had the accident in 2011.
Wow. Whoa. Alex, and it's like what I've read is, and they don't know how long it will take. They don't know quite how to do this. They don't know. I mean, they haven't planned for this kind of scenario.
In fact, the Japanese government has just admitted they don't know what to do. They've asked for international help. Mm-hmm. Every country mm-hmm. in the world, and mm-hmm. especially every country on the Pacific,
yes.
should be deeply, yes. deeply involved in this. Because when the accident happened, a lot of radioactivity was carried in the air straight over the whole West Coast. We measured it in Simon Fraser University, went and measured it in Vancouver area. It was measured down at the University at Berkeley in San Francisco. It was measured in Washington State. And it kept going from there in lesser amounts right over the whole of the United States and right around the whole Northern Hemisphere. It was measured in Scandinavia and in Europe and even into Russia. So it was a worldwide event of radiation sprayed over the world. Ever since then, though, it's been coming into the Pacific. The Pacific's a big place. So far, it's being diluted to an extent, but neither the Canadian or American governments have released any testing on fish to tell us whether, for example, the salmon coming back, are they safe to eat? The fisheries that go out into the far Pacific and catch fish, tuna, and everything else, and bring it back, is it safe? We don't know. They're not telling us. There's no figures. Are they testing it? We don't know that either.
Which, of course, leads one to think the worst. They're not telling us because there would be a panic. The fishing industries would probably collapse, all that kind of. That's the first thought
yes.
in terms of government cover-ups. I have heard of one report of something like 12 or 15 bluefin tuna down in Southern California, all of whom had higher levels of radiation. They're just keeping a lid on this.
Well, this coming year of 2014 is when the radiation will have definitely reached far enough to reach the West Coast, mm-hmm. just the way the ocean circuits work. And it will keep on coming because they don't have it under control. Neither the operator TEPCO nor the Japanese government have Fukushima under control. So when they have typhoons, as they just had two or three of them, and a tropical storm wash over, this stuff just washes down through the groundwater, through those lost radioactive cores, and out into the ocean. And it will keep circulating for decades, I would say, unless we can bring it under control somehow. The Japanese have said, well, maybe we'll freeze all the ground all around the reactor site. It's a gigantic multi-billion-dollar project, never been done before. Don't know if we can do it, but until something happens, this is worse than Chernobyl in the way that it's continuing.
Yeah, so I'd read something, you know, three times, maybe more than that, radiation compared to Chernobyl.
It is, but most of it went into the Pacific, which is the good news and the bad news,
right,
as far as humans are concerned that live on land. And there's one last thing we should talk about when it comes to Fukushima, and that is that the nuclear fuel rods, especially in this building called Building 4, that were perched up above the reactor, the buildings were severely damaged by explosions. They're just teetering there. And the Japanese have tried to build them up with special reinforcing structures, and they've done a decent job on Building 4, but it's still not ready should there be another earthquake. They have earthquakes there all the time, running up to 4, 4.5. It's quite normal for that area. If they have one that's 6 or 7, Building 4 could collapse. And there are various nuclear experts who I give a lot of credit to who have warned that is the single biggest threat to mankind in the Northern Hemisphere. Because if Building 4 collapses, there's radioactivity in there that has just never been seen before, released at one time on planet Earth. So that's something to worry about and something to keep your eye out for. I don't know what we could do. Really, there's nothing you or I can do if that happens.
You know, it occurs to me as you say that, because you and I aren't going to affect what's happening there, it sort of underscores enjoying each day, enjoying the lives we have now, you know, being good to each other. I mean, which sounds really simplistic, and yet what I hear is a higher level of uncertainty that what may happen out of Fukushima because they're in an earthquake zone. We may have that kind of terminal event with more illness, you know.
It's possible. Cancer would spread wildly if it happened. I'm hoping it won't happen.
Of course.
And I think there are some things we could do. And one of the things we could do is there are about 22 of the same design reactors, and they're fatally flawed design from General Electric, mm-hmm. that have the fuel rods come up from the bottom. And that means there are holes in the bottom. And if they have an accident, the nuclear fuel cuts directly down, and we could have Fukushima's in the United States.
Wow.
So number one is get a hold of your congressman or senator and say, I don't want a Fukushima in the United States. If we're running these Mark I General Electric reactors, shut them down today. Get a hold of
That's
the
good.
Nuclear Regulatory Commission and shut those down. America has enough power it can run without them. We don't need that electricity. So that's a no-brainer. We found out what happens in Fukushima if there's an accident. Mm-hmm. And we've had some near misses in the United States, like when that reactor in, I think it was North Dakota, was flooded. And there were floods all around it. If the power lines went down, bingo, there you go.
Yes.
So in the short term, get rid of those reactors. In the longer term, no more nuclear power.
Yes,
it doesn't
of course.
Work.
Of course.
It's too dangerous for humans to run. If we had a perfect world, the physics of them make sense. But in a real human society, we haven't made them fail safe.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for laying out. It's better that we know than we pretend otherwise. Any other things that are sort of close to your mind or your heart that, you know, that you've sniffed out through EcoShock that you want to add?
Well, on Radio EcoShock, I do spend a lot of time talking to the more hopeful people who are trying to do the things that you cover in Peak Moment TV. And it's localization, and it's food production, and it's gardening, and it's community building.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
it's also psychological preparation that the world may not continually improve. That's what we were told during the time we were growing up. And in fact, the world may become more difficult and more challenging. But humans can rise to those challenges socially. As long as we don't wipe ourselves out with climate change mm-hmm. or nuclear power mm-hmm. or toxic pollution, we can rearrange our society. We can become more flexible. We can expect less materially and more in happiness. And I think that's the real key to how we will survive.
I think that when you think of the evolutionary sense, what cultures did were, you know, you either flee if things get bad, you go elsewhere, which of course civilizations have done, or you have to adapt. And there is no somewhere else. I mean, we've got planet Earth and it's all feeling the effects. So that adaptability, that flexibility, the creativity, I mean, that's part of what I see in Peak Moment that's really exciting is people are rising with levels of creativity on how to do different economies or different money or different food systems and that are more perennial. And it's encouraging. It's really encouraging.
And there's people of all ages, too.
I'm
seeing seniors come out with a lot. I'm seeing young people in their 20s come out with a lot. And even I just listened to a speech by a 12-year-old girl from British Columbia at PowerShift 2013. And she's a powerful speaker. So even the kids, you know, and their fridge magnets and their artwork, they're saying, we want to change. We want a good world.
And I thank you because part of what you're doing in laying out the Radio EcoShock is you do, you want a better world, and part of it's being informed about what's going on and what we can do. Thank you for that. Okay, we're going to get on the line and get our American nuclear plants closed up. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate the chance to talk with you and with your viewers.
You're watching Peak Moment TV. I'm Janaea Donaldson. My guest is Alex Smith, the host and producer of Radio EcoShock. Thank you. Join us again.
My appearance on Peak Moment TV will be broadcast on Community Access Television and on YouTube later this month. I'll tip you off when it comes out. I've been a fan of Peak Moment TV for a couple of years now, so I took this opportunity while I was in Vancouver to ask host Janaea Donaldson how it all got started and why she thinks we are living in that peak moment of human history.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock, and I'm here with a source that you should really know about. It's called Peak Moment TV, and I'm here with the host, Janaea Donaldson, and I'm going to let her explain what she is doing and why you should know about it.
Thank you, Alex. That's wonderful. Peak Moment TV originated when I learned about peak oil, and that was about 2005. Prior to that, my partner Robin and I were already tuned into climate change through Bill McKibben. But I thought peak oil might be the place where our wallets would start to create changes in behavior when the economy, you know, felt the effects of cheap oil going away. We started Peak Moment TV because we wanted to let our neighbors know about what was going on. And when I say peak moment, my sense of this isn't just this year or even just this decade, but that we're at an arc of a peak moment in history, certainly a peak of certain resources, the non-renewables, and enormous population, that we would need to see contraction in the material sense of not a consumer society. So what my first question is, if it's going to be a whole lot more expensive to get food in my town, my little rural town in Northern California, where will that food come from? Well, it has to come from my local area. So we started videoing shows with people who may not have been thinking about peak oil per se, or may not have been thinking about climate change, but were looking at local food, growers' markets, permaculture, natural building, local money. So that's where it started. And we began to find more and more people all through the Northwest. We would travel. We have traveled. We are traveling. And finding the creativity, the innovation, the ideas, people trying things, becoming more neighborly, taking care of each other, sharing tools, sharing cars. So hopeful signs everywhere about people in this peak moment coming together on their local level. So Peak Moment TV is at peakmoment.tv on the web. We have, at this point, 245 shows, free, all on the internet. And we find that people are changing their lives, being inspired by them, which makes us feel really good, really glad to do that. You know, it's one of those little signs of hope at this point. The people that we're getting to meet, the brain being inspired by all over.
I'm trying to do more of that. I went to the Mother Earth News Fair, and I met about 13 people there that were really inspiring. They had come as speakers, and we ran a series of interviews on Radio EcoShock. Everything like aquaponics, for example, very interesting topic, raising fish with food in a whole natural cycle. There are a lot of great ideas out there. I just spoke with Lawrence Boomert of New Zealand, and he has the Bank of Solutions.
Yes, the Bank of Real Solutions.
Bank of Real Solutions.
Yes,
isn't that great?
We just interviewed him, so we'll have some of that up on Peak Moment. Yeah, it is. And his solutions include the alternate monies, and when the government couldn't pay for adult education anymore, they had their alternate money exchange ready to go, and they just kept going on with doing their classes. You know, without the currency, you know, the New Zealand currency. Those are great examples. We've interviewed some folks, speaking of hydroponics, there's a show that we just put out within the last few months of folks doing exactly what you're talking about with the hydroponics. What people most want to know on the Peak Moment channel is, what can we do at the individual and family level? What can we do in our backyard? And then they start to think about, well, what can my neighbor and I or the folks up the street do together? We visited folks in Victoria at McCaskill Street who got together, learned a bit about what they could do, you know, for a transition to less energy. So they looked at energy and food and water, found out that there was a new kind of efficient heat pump. And all of them got rebates so that for nearly free, they have far more efficient space heating because they got together as neighbors and learned about that. You know, I think that's where the hope lies, is down here in the grassroots.
You talked about Peak Oil. I just did an interview with a fellow from Berlin who is part of a joint study in both Europe and the United States. The University of Maryland was involved on Peak Oil. And I thought, well, Peak Oil, yes, Richard Heinberg, yes, mm-hmm. a lot of us who have been doing alternative thinking. But no, it's being studied by universities and it's being studied by the military, by a lot of people who can see that oil is not just a free thing that comes out of the earth forever. It's definitely limited. And he was saying that, well, we have to redefine what peak oil is. Really, it's not that we're going to run out of oil. It's that it just gets more and more expensive, dirtier and dirtier to produce, harder and harder to find. And that's exactly what we have with the tar sands, what we have with deep water drilling, and oil's, you know, $90, $100 a barrel these days. It's pretty expensive.
Yes.
So I think that people are going to experience that for sure. Do you cover that in your program?
We have not covered, and I do want to cover, fracking, because I think that people are being given the story that that's going to be the bridge that'll take over for where the more expensive oil is, and I see that not happening. So we'll probably do some updates on that. Because what bottom line was going to matter to the ordinary person is, how am I going to feed my family? You know, the economics of living. Those are the places where people can have the most effect, is how they choose to live their lives. It's part of why we see people sharing houses, living in tiny houses, things that will allow them to physically maybe appear to be less wealthy, but it's being balanced, as you said, in relationships that are more nurturing, that are healthier, that are making up for the less in the material world.
Janaea, you mentioned that it's Peak Moment TV. Where's the TV part?
Well, somebody just told us we should call it, it's Tell-A-Vision. So that even though it's on the internet, we are on the internet and we are on community TV stations in America and a couple of other places in the world. So people can find us at peakmoment.tv. There's also a Peak Moment channel on YouTube. But the TV, of course, is a throwback to television, because we're not on the big flat screen televisions, unless you have that. We're on the internet. But we really do have a lot of guests who are just ordinary folks who really are telling their vision of a thriving in a very different world that's more contracted physically, but richer from the inside.
Well, I've watched a bunch of episodes that you have going on the net, and I've really enjoyed them. So you have been one of my favorite spots to visit.
You're sweet, Alex.
No,
thank
it's true.
You. Thank you.
I've learned a lot. You have some good guests, and we all have to learn. It's a re-education process all the time. There's no end of school these days.
That's true.
Because
that's true.
The society and the climate and our energy systems are changing so rapidly. So I really want to thank you for joining me on Radio EcoShock, Janaea Donaldson of Peak Moment TV.
Peak Moment TV. Thank you, Alex. It's been nice to be here.
Check out the Radio EcoShock weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about your world.